I've been around here not quite 3 years, and she's one of the reasons that I wish I'd come in earlier. So let's please wish best of luck for Carol in delivering her story tonight.
Hello, my name's Carol, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'm very honored to be telling my story on my exact day of my 20th anniversary. I've been reflecting on 20 years and preparing to tell this story, and yesterday I became just overwhelmed with gratitude about how different my life could have turned out had I not stepped into these rooms. So what was it like? I'll tell you what it was like for me. I was born in Michigan, and I'm the oldest of five kids. I have four younger brothers. We were all born within a quick time period of 7 years. I was a very anxious and shy child. Early pictures of me sitting on Santa's lap show someone just terrified to be there. I didn't speak much. Even when I was in kindergarten, I had speech therapy because I didn't speak at all. I still have my kindergarten report card, and it says if Carol could learn to relax and not be so afraid, she would do really well. And so I was just very, very, anxious and very shy as a child. When I was 8 years old, an event happened that really has profoundly changed in the course of my life. My mother was diagnosed with a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And, when you're 8 years old and the word cancer, you have no idea what that means. And, it can mean sore throat to you. I mean, you have no idea what that means. And, as time wore on, she'd be in and out of the hospital. She'd be going for radiation. She'd be very sick. The adults were crying. All these different things would happen. And I started to figure out that something was going on. And my parents had bought us kids the World Book Encyclopedias, and I was a, fairly smart kid. And so I looked up the word cancer. I was probably 9 years old, and it said the word fatal. And I didn't know what fatal meant, and I looked it up, and it said death. And I think that my anxiety and fear turned into total dread at that time. And so as I went through life, as I went through grade school, and all my friends were playing and doing all these different things, I was in terrible fear that my mother had died that day. And when I was around 12 years old, I found a note she had written while she was in the hospital, and it said, "I know I'm going to die soon." And I just, I was consumed with thinking that she had died that day. And my way to deal with it was to be outside as much as possible and away from the house. I mean, I didn't want to be in that terrible house. And so I would be outside playing or in the woods or climbing a tree and staying out as late as I could. And, my mother would sit there reading Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's On Death and Dying with tears streaming down her face, and I wouldn't know what to do with that. I would just be away. And by the time I was 14, I went from Catholic school to a public school, and I started hanging out with the bad neighborhood girl from next door who was a year older than me, and I found a way better way to escape. And, this has been my progression, literally, with drugs and alcohol. I swear, and I don't know, maybe my memory's flawed, but I swear I drank one day. 2 weeks later, I tried pot. And 2 weeks later, I tried acid. And I was never, ever looked back from that. And up until I started trying to quit about 12 years later, I don't think I ever missed a day. And so I went from being, a fairly good and responsible kid to failing ninth grade. I had entire classes that I never went to once the entire semester. If I did go, I'd bring a McDonald's cup full of vodka or wine. I would sit in high school and drink. I had friends' parents who didn't want me to hang out with them because I sold drugs. I mean, I just went to the extreme. And when my friends would take one hit of acid, I would take four. I mean, it was the best way to be completely numb to the fact that I had, a mother now at this point laying in the middle of the living room because she can't get up at night. I mean, can't get up the stairs to go to bed at night. So now we have a bed in the middle of the living room. And When I started my first week of 11th grade, I got called out of class, and I was supposed to take the car home because my mother needed to go back down to Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit one more time. And on this, and this had happened 1,000 times, you know, I mean, of the, you know, is she dying and then she'd get better, and then is she dying and then she'd get better. And by this time, you know, 8 years have gone by. And on this particular day, my dad didn't come home for a long time, and when he came home, he had been crying. And I said, what's going on? And he said, well, your mother's not expected to live through the night. And so I did what I always did, and I went out with two friends partying and drinking, and I was quiet. And one of them said to me, why are you so quiet? And I said, well, my mother's not expected to live through the night. And they both burst into tears, and I looked at them like, why are you crying? I was so disconnected from my feelings at that point that I couldn't feel anything, you know, any connection at all. And within a couple days later, my mother did die. She was 41 years old. We were 16, 15, 13, 11, and 9 when my mother died. And, you know, part of we will not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it is saying things that that people know that you can forgive yourself for, but I actually sold pot at the funeral home when my mother died, and it's not one of the things that I'm proud of, but it's the way that it was, you know? And so I barely graduated from high school and, you know, did what I did with my drugs and alcohol and you know, drinking. I used to even, you know, take acid on Christmas Day with my family and sit there on Christmas Day with them and do all these crazy things. And so I graduated from high school and I moved to Florida because I hated the cold, and I moved to Naples, Florida. And, you know, this is what I call, it's Southern Florida, it's the early 80s, think Al Pacino and Scarface. I mean, that's, I feel like the reality of the life that I lived was it became all about cocaine. And I hung out with a bunch of really good-looking girls, and there was no shortage of men in their 40s and 50s that had a lot of money and a lot of drugs. And we would fly to New York City for dinner, and we would fly to Acapulco, and we would fly to the Bahamas. And, you know, sometimes along the way I would find out that two in particular, they were hitmen, and they were also counterfeiters. And they used to give us $100 bills that we used to go out and spend, and I had no idea I was spending counterfeit money. So it was pretty crazy. And I worked in a restaurant, and you know, you go into work at 4, you start drinking by 8, you get off work, you go out, you know, you're doing cocaine that whole time, and next thing you know, it's 10 o'clock the next morning, you try to go home and go to sleep before you have to be back to work at 4, and sometimes you don't even do that, you just go to work in the same clothes that you were working in the day before. And that was the life that I was leading. And during this time, since it was slower in winter, I did seasons. I went back to Michigan in the summertime, and I stayed in Florida in the wintertime. And the summer I went home, I was 20 years old. I was there maybe 3 weeks. And my youngest brother, who was 14, and he was the one that was everybody's personal favorite. I had pretty much raised him because my mother was diagnosed with cancer when he was 1, and she died when he was 9. And he wanted to be in the military because my brother that was behind me in age was now in Army Rangers. And my brother, Kenny, that was in the military, was telling them about certain exercises you did in the military where you swam with a bunch of weight on. And so my brother Brian, the 14-year-old, put rocks in his pockets and put all this weight on and was swimming with two other little boys and drowned in the river behind our house. And he was 14 years old. And I was there at the time when they were looking for his body, and I was there standing on the riverbank, and there was a Coast Guard helicopter going by, and I looked and I saw a full moon, and I thought, fuck you, God, I will never have anything to do with you. And that really posed a big problem when I came into AA several years later. So that happened. I had a really hard time functioning after that particular summer. Everything, I thought, this is really unfair, you know. I mean, I lived for 8 years with this death of my mother, and then this, 14-year-old dies young like this. And I just really, really had a hard time. And the only way to deal with it was, of course, to continue doing the drugs and the alcohol. And I moved back to Florida, and I eventually stayed there. And my life continued with the, working in restaurants, lots of cocaine. I have a couple funny stories. One was that I went to one of my wild roommates and I decided we were going to go to the Super Bowl. I think it was 1982 or 83 in Tampa Bay. And we left at 9:30 on a Friday morning. And we were up partying the entire time, never got any sleep. And it ended up with me. I lost her somewhere along the way, but I ended up with some man, twice my age, climbing on the back of a police van and jumping over the 12-foot fence and sat on the 50-yard line of the Super Bowl game. And up until a couple years ago, I'd never been to a pro football game except for the Super Bowl, and I got in for free. And I don't even really remember much about the game, except I can tell you it was the Washington Redskins, because all these people were wearing these little pig faces, those little pig snouts that they wear. And I mean, after being up for 3 days, they look really bizarre. And another story I promised a friend I would tell. This story was us driving home one night, and I never got pulled over. When I did get pulled over, I got out of it. I mean, this was back in the 80s where they would, they let you go. I mean, it's not like today. I was driving home one morning, probably about 5 o'clock in the morning, and I could not remember if you go on a green light or a red light. And I couldn't even think of it in terms of green or red. I thought of it as top or bottom. Which one do I go? But then I remembered that the middle one was something middle, so you could drive through that. So I would wait for the yellow light and drive through, and that's the way that I drove home. So during this time, I have people talking to me, telling me that I have a problem. I was trying to go to college at one point, and I would wear sunglasses in class because I haven't been to bed yet from the day before, and the fluorescent lights would be so bright. And I had a teacher, the class was personal health and development or personal growth and development or something, and she was also the school counselor, and she pulled me into her office and asked me to take off my sunglasses and saw my very dilated eyes and said, I'm going to call a treatment center for you. And I'm like, oh, no, there's no way. And then I had bosses that would say, come and see me. Rumor has it that you have a bad drug problem. And when you are talked to by your boss in the restaurant business, usually you have a bad drug problem because everybody's an alcoholic. And all these different things are telling me that I have a problem. And I'm just, I don't believe it. And also during this time, I did get married, and he partied right alongside with me. But he eventually stopped drinking. And then he started to not want to do coke anymore either. And he started getting on my back about my problem. And I wasn't able to hear anything. And I want to tell about two moments of clarity that I had during this time frame. And, I think we all have that moment where we, and sometimes it's just a moment and it's gone very quickly, where we know that there's something wrong with our life. And it's sometimes some weird things. And one of mine was I paid for a trip to go to Europe for a month. And most of it was prepaid, the dinners and all. And I went by myself, but I was on a tour with a lot of other college kids. And if they didn't have alcohol, included in that, I would go out and find my own alcohol and take off on my own. Well, my last night, I was in Athens, Greece, and it was 1985, and it was about 3 weeks previous that jet had been hijacked and held hostage on the runway for a couple of weeks. And so it was like a terrorist year. A lot of other things had happened. And I'm in Athens, Greece, and it's about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm in this terrible warehouse, deserted, pitch black district. And I walked by like a car that looks like it had been a car bomb. It was destroyed. And I looked up at the moon. And it's funny how all my messages seem to come from the moon. I had this moment of clarity that something's wrong with your life, Carol. This is not right. And, you know, of course it was gone. And I came back and I kept doing what I was doing. And my other moment was I was... probably because I was a cocaine user, I was prone to a lot of strep throat and sore throat and throat infections, and so I was forever going to the doctor and getting antibiotics, and I knew that you couldn't take them and drink on them, and so the drink always won. And one time I was moving and I found a cardboard box under the sink with 17 full bottles of amoxicillin that I could be where the drink had won out, and I remember thinking, oh, there might be a problem here. But of course, that came and went. Well, one day out of the blue sky, and I say blue sky, but it was a blue sky to me, my old crazy roommate, the one I lost at the Super Bowl, who had now had two children and a husband, called me and said, I am so sick and tired of you doing cocaine in my house around my two small children. I don't want you in my home anymore. And I've made an appointment with a treatment center for you. Well, I was completely floored, because it was okay when bosses and husbands and, but this was my crazy partying friend, you know, and so I agreed to go, and I immediately thought they wanted my money, and I just blew out of there. But I did agree to start seeing a counselor, so she and I looked up drugs and alcohol in the Yellow Pages, and I started seeing a therapist. And every week, the therapist for about 9 months said the exact same words to me every single week, Carol, I can't help you. You need treatment. And every week I'd go back, you know, and I'd hear that same thing. And I'd try to go one day, you know, and I'd get sometimes one day in there. And I actually got 3 days in a row once. But for the most part, there would never be a day that I would miss between appointments where I wasn't using. And then, you know, when we think that the promises don't come true for us, the one, you know, that we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. I mean, I think that happens for anybody that has walked into these doors. Because why do you walk into these doors? Well, one day I went out and I was going to do my same, you know, I'm still going to the same therapist. I'm still doing the same thing I always did. And I wasn't going to drink. And I thought, well, I'm just going to have one beer. Well, that turned into two, turned into vodka, turned into cocaine, turned into trying to hide it from my husband and all the same old stuff. And I woke up the next day and I had had enough. And that to me is, you know, that promise. And so I called that therapist and I said, where do you want me to go? And within 14 hours, I was 90 miles away in Punta Gorda at a treatment center. And I did the 28 days. Actually, I think they kept me a couple extra days because I wasn't following the rules. And, you know, I got out, I went to meetings, and I had this was in 1989. I'm 28 years old. And I had every intention of staying sober. And I would go to meetings in Naples. And this is where the problem that was really hard for me at the beginning was I was very afraid of people. And I saw people talking, you know, about sponsors, and I knew what that was, and I knew I needed to get one. But I was so afraid of approaching people that I would go to meetings, and I would just sit there very quiet, and then I would leave. And I'm sure there's probably maybe 15 people in this room that either do that now or have done that, where they just, it's so hard to reach out. And I've joked with friends about, you know, that I couldn't call and order a pizza because I was bothering the pizza people, and I'm afraid, but that's the truth. I mean, I remember not making doctor's appointments because I feel like I'm bothering the receptionist if I call. And so for me to reach out to people, I wasn't doing that while I was going to meetings. And so I went to meetings for about 5 months, and finally I made a friend, and I was so happy because she was a crack addict and she was cool. And we made plans to go to the beach, and she never showed. And so I was so mad, those fucking AA people, and they don't know what they're doing, and they're still this, and whatever. And so I went out and got drunk. But you know what? The seed had been planted, and I quickly realized that the way that I felt about myself was terrible, and I came right back. And I repeated this pattern for about 4 or 5 more months, where I'd get like a month or two and then go back out, and because I'm still not reaching out. And the problem was is that when I would experience something, like rejection was a big one for me, like that girl rejecting me, I wouldn't know what to do with it. I'm not talking to anybody, and so I get drunk. And so anyway, 20 years ago yesterday, I had a couple months in again, and I had gone out again. I had something happen at work. I didn't like it. I got angry. I didn't know what to do with it. I'm not talking to anybody, and I went out again 20 years ago last night. Well, 20 years ago this morning, I woke up, and the self-hatred I felt because I had drank again was so great that I wanted to beat my head against the headboard until I bled to death and died. I mean, it was just, and that self-hatred's pretty much what propelled me to really end up staying sober. And so I went to a meeting a couple days later, and meanwhile, still not talking to anyone, still know that you need something called a sponsor, and not being able to do it, being way too afraid of people. And this woman chased me down in the parking lot and yelled at me because I was, you know, she said I had a big ego because what I had to say must be so important that I couldn't share it. I don't really know what she meant by that, but she appointed herself my sponsor. And she said, I want you to call me every single day. So for me, I haven't drank since. So for me personally, that's the single most important thing, is getting sober and staying sober. And staying sober is to be able to talk to someone. I mean, you really have to find someone that you can talk to about anything and everything. For me, that was the most important thing. So that was 20 years ago. So what is it like for me now? And, you know, I was thinking earlier, how do you sum up 20 years in 15 minutes? And because I've been sober longer than I drank for 14 years, it seems like more of my struggles have happened in sobriety than, you know, the drinking part of it. And so I'm going to try to go through some of those struggles that I've had. And I remember being about 6 months sober, and a woman came into a meeting, and she had 24 years of sobriety, and she said she was crazy, and she was going to go to Hazelden for a month-long, you know, treatment center, even though she hadn't drank. And I remember judging her very harshly, thinking, what's wrong with that? You know, 24 years of sobriety, and she's got to go in because, you know, she's crazy. Well, now, in hindsight for me, 20 years, I have realized that you have cycles in sobriety, and you have what I call cruising years that you just kind of cruise through. Things are okay. You might have some learning experiences, but overall, it's okay. And then you have some moderate years where, there's some kind of good learning experiences, things that happen. And then you have the really deeply painful, profound years. And in my 20 years, I've had 3 of those time frames that I can think of. And I seem to be on like this 5-year cycle, because one happened around 5 years, one happened around 11 years, and then the last one happened around 16 years. And I want to talk about the first one. And, you know, and the advantage of going through a really, really tough time, the first time you think you're not going to live through it. But once you get through a tough time, when you have tough times later on, you remember that you lived through the last one, and you might not like it while you're in it, but that you're going to survive. You're going to be able to get through it. And my first 5 years of sobriety, they weren't real easy. I mean, I still worked in restaurants. I don't recommend working in restaurants and trying to get sober. I mean, literally 90% of the people are alcoholics, and you work with alcohol, and you have fast money, and you work at night. But that being said, I worked in restaurants for 18 years in my sobriety, and I'm still sober. But it wasn't an easy thing. So, you know, those first 5 years of working in restaurants, restaurants was hard. I romanticized alcohol. I saw everybody partying. I thought often that my life was better when I was drinking. I really had a hard time. And then things got worse. At about 4.5 years of sobriety, the external things going on were, I was going through a divorce by this time. I was having a very big change in lifestyle. And I had 11 jobs over the course of 2 years. And about on job number 6, I realized it wasn't them, it was me. And so that was what was going on externally, but internally was that I thought I was deeply flawed, that I always felt that I was never satisfied. I was never happy. The next thing was going to make me happy. And when I got the next thing, then I would be happy. And then when I would get them, I wouldn't be happy. And there's a line in the 7th step, and it characterized my life. Never was there enough of what we thought we wanted. And that's how I felt. And so I thought, everybody else knows how to live their life and being satisfied, and I'm not. And there's something profoundly wrong with me. And that the only way to cure that was to kill myself. And this was a really, this has been the worst emotional bottom of my life, was at this 5 years of sobriety, worse than the deaths in my family. And it was an incredibly hard time frame. And so I eventually, okay, I've got to backtrack a little bit on spirituality too. When my mother was sick and dying from cancer, I went to Catholic school, and I would put my entire allowance down in the drop box at the Catholic church to light the candles, praying for my mother to live. And then she died. And then my brother drowned. And then when I walked into AA and I saw God on the wall, I was so disappointed that this was a God thing. And so I spent literally almost 2 years, when I was trying to get sober in the beginning, walking out of God meetings. I would stick around for other meetings, but I wasn't going to have anything to do with the God part. Until, during that time I was kept relapsing, I heard an old-timer share about that she had never heard of anybody go back out and drink again that had sincerely asked for help that morning. And she said, sincerely, not just mouthing the words, but saying, please, I don't want to drink today. Please help me. And so I thought, well, I can at least do that. And so I started doing that, haven't drank since. And then little by little, I realized that the people that had what I wanted, which was peace and serenity, were the ones that talked about spiritual things. And so I thought, well, I'm going to have to come up with a God, and it's not going to be the God that I grew up with. So I started using the wind as my higher power. Today would have been a great God day because it's very And then I had another sign from God. My name's Carol Grant, and we say, God, grant me the serenity. And I thought, oh, God Grant, we must be related somehow. So this is some kind of sign that I'm okay to do this. And that's where I was, you know, at 5 years, and I hit that terrible place. And I thought I was doing a 3rd step. I would turn things over, but I would say, I don't know what to do with this. I'm going to turn it over to you, whatever you is. But I want A, B, or C to happen. And that was my version of turning things over. Well, when I hit this terrible place at 5 years, I didn't care what happened. I just wanted to feel better. And some people might surrender when they come in the program immediately because they're so desperate and whatever, and they're willing to do anything to not drink. That was not my case. I became more desperate at the 5 years, and I was willing to do whatever it took to feel better. And so I went on a quest, and I started delving into Eastern religions. A lot of people in Naples were into Emmett Fox. I started reading Emmett Fox. I just anything to find my sense of a higher power. I picked up something called A Course in Miracles 15 years ago. That has been my practice that I've done now for 15 years, and it has been a lifesaver for me. So that was the spiritual. Okay, so now back to the 5 years. When I started doing, realizing that I could turn things over and find relief, I found relief from my own mind, the mind that told me nothing was ever enough. And to me, that was like the first miracle for me, was to have relief from my own mind. And so after that, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, I went through what I call cruising years. It was, you know, a good time. And then at 11 years of sobriety, a relationship I was in of 6 years ended, and I was very, very devastated about that. And what I eventually figured out is that it was forcing me to deal with the losses in my life of my mother and my brother that I'd never dealt with, because I had just used my way through all of that. And so now I'm feeling this tremendous amount of grief and kind of this hopelessness and this loneliness. And I'm really grateful to the sponsor I had at that time, because she said, stay with it. Don't try to do anything to chase it away. And I think that's something we do in the program, is, you know, we don't like what we feel. We want to feel different, so we drink and use drugs. Then we get that taken away, and some of us will turn to food. Some of us will turn to sex. Some of us will turn to working. Some of us will turn to shopping. Anything to still not feel that feeling. And a lot of people think that it's going to be solved by getting in a relationship with someone. You know, just let me be in a relationship, and then I won't have to feel the way that I'm feeling. Well, my sponsor at this time said, don't do any of those things. Just stay with it. Well, I hate to say that that time period lasted two years, but I call it the time period where I made friends with hopelessness. What that's done for me now is I'm not afraid of it anymore. I am not afraid to feel negative feelings. I know they're a part of life, and that's what's going to happen, and that they're sometimes going to be there, and that I don't need to do something to chase that away. So I'm really grateful to that time period where I just sat with that for 2 years. And then I went through another couple years, cruising years, where, you know, life was good and I was doing well. And I think I changed from kind of this, I'd always thought of myself as this melancholy, Janis Joplin, Kurt Cobain kind of morose, you know, sad person. And something flip-flopped in me where I'm not that person at all anymore. I'm just not that person, and I thought I would be that way my entire life. And so I'm really glad that I went through what I went through to get rid of that. Around 16 years of sobriety, I started to really hit a bottom in my work life, and I am going to talk a little bit about my struggles with work, but I got fired from a job after 7 years, and I thought it was really shitty the way they did it, and I was very resentful over it. And within a couple weeks, and I was taking them to court and all kinds of things, and within a couple weeks, my right eye was very blurry, and I went to a doctor, and they sent me to, I went to an eye doctor, and they sent me to a retina specialist who sent me to a neurologist, and I was diagnosed with MS. And that kind of explained a lot of the symptoms that I'd had over my life. And so they put me on interferon. And if anybody's ever been on interferon or knows the people on interferon, it's a very nasty drug. Not only do you have, you know, a high temperature and you feel like you've had the worst flu you've ever had, it depletes your serotonin. And so now you're not only sick, you're depressed. And I was on it for 2 months, and I finally said, thanks, but no thanks. I'm going to treat it holistically, and I have never regretted that decision, and that was in 2006. And so from there, you know, I'm not working. I'm still in a battle with this job. I'm not feeling very good. You know, things are going wrong. I've moved out of my house. I have a mortgage that, you know, I can't pay for. I lived in a couple different places. And then, lo and behold, I end up one day in the hospital with a perforated colon. And a couple months later, I had to have 18 inches of my colon removed, and I end up spending 11 days in the hospital over those two trips. So during the 16, 17 years, I felt very angry, and this was unfair. And, you know, we say hungry, angry, lonely, tired, not to get any of those. And in Florida, we used to add S for sick. To me, sick is the worst. I mean, I can deal with hungry, I can deal with angry, lonely, tired, I can sleep, but sick, there's nothing you can do about it when you're sick. And I just had to ride through that phase. And now it's been a couple years later, And I feel great. I've been doing very well. I got a renter in my house. I mean, things have really, really turned around, so that's been really good. So I'm back in my cruising years right now, and I'm very happy. And I did just want to briefly talk about work, and this is something that I wouldn't have been very honest about a couple years ago, but I have struggled with work for a long time. In 20 years of sobriety, I've probably had 50 jobs. And like I said, you know, you realize at some point it's not them, it's you. And, you know, when I picked up my five-year chip, in Florida they say the first 5 years don't count, which really pisses you off. Because they do, but I do realize that they meant that the person you are suddenly doesn't work for you anymore. And that's what I hit with the work. And at 5 years of sobriety, when I had the 11 jobs, I had a sponsor who made me do a fourth step on work. And if you have a lot of work problems, it's a good idea. And she made me fill it out like almost like a job application. What, where you worked, what happened, what do you think the pattern was? And I started to see that I went to jobs, I tried to prove myself how good I was, I took on too much, I became overwhelmed, I expected them to read my mind and know that it was too much for me, but yet I couldn't confront them, and then the only way, then I'd get resentful, and then the only way was to quit. So I got to see a really great pattern. Unfortunately, you know, I still had a lot of jobs in the subsequent years, and I stayed in the restaurant business. And a lot of people that are around me, I hated what I did. I hated it for a long, long time. And a lot of people around me knew that I could do better and I could get out. And 2 years ago when, you know, I got sick two or three years ago and I couldn't work in restaurants, I was forced to doing other stuff. And I got out of restaurants because I realized that every time I went to a restaurant, I got sick. And now I've had a job for a year. I work in public health, and I also am part-time office manager here. And I look back, and I'm like, why was that such a big deal? But I'm the type of person, and there's a lot of people in the program like this, that you don't take a step in a new direction. You don't take a step on the staircase if you can't see the top of the staircase. If I don't know what's going to happen and whether I'm going to like it and all the things, that every single detail, then I won't even take a step in that direction. I have to have it all figured out. And I, you know, I got to the point where I didn't have to have it figured out, and I just moved, and it's been wonderful. And I don't know why I struggled all those years like I did, and I didn't have to, but I did. So, you know, now life is very good for me, and I really feel as though the greatest thing that I have is a deep sense of peace. And I firmly believe that there is no spiritual part of the program. The program is spiritual. And that because I do a lot of outside spiritual practices, it's my deal, what I do, and you know, anybody else can have some other spiritual practices. But it's given me relief from my own mind. It's just given me deep peace and a lot of joy. And for that, I am really, really grateful. My life is very, very different than it could have been. So I just wanted to say thank you all. Thank you to all my friends who showed up. And thanks.
Great job. Thank you. On a yellow light, are you supposed to speed up or slow down?
No, you're so
cool. Oh, okay. Our seventh tradition states that there are no dues or fees for AA membership, but your generosity helps this group out and AA its own. And I've asked Tinsley to hand out the chips.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to throw in with the rest of us and join this way of life, we offer a white chip. Anybody want a white chip? For 30 days, we have a silver chip. All right. Uh, 90 days, we have a red chip. If I got 6 months, yellow chip. Green chip for 9 months. Birthdays, year multiples.
Who are you?
How many? That's not enough. Thank you.
Any other takers on the blue chip? I'd like to offer the white chip one more time. Anybody who's shy, free yourself. Big hand for the chips you hold.
Okay. And do we have any AA-related announcements? Yes, Brian.
My name is Brian. I'm Paulus over alcohol.
Hey, Paulus.
I'm the key to literature cabin. I'll be at the cabin after the meeting.
Get your literature there. Yes, sir.
That's right. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Frank.
A reminder about the NAVA membership meeting is this Sunday, January 31st, 1 o'clock in this room. The old NAVA chairs are themselves $5. And any literature outside the cabinet, out from the side of the glass, don't give Brian any money for it. That's all free of you.
Yes, sir.
I've got an outside one. For people to jam with. Like,
hi, John.
My name's John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, John.
I play guitar and harmonica. I just like to find some people to jam with that are sober, maybe after the 5:45 meeting or something, because I'm going crazy. So, yeah, if anybody sober wants to...
Okay, see, John, he's itching to make music. Okay.
Okay.
Tim,
I'm an
alcoholic. Hey, Tim.
Yeah. And Connie has a cake back here, so everyone's welcome to come. Have a piece of cake, give him some coffee, so feel free to come back here.
All right, and next week we've got Bruce H. from Skyland. He's got a little over 20 years himself. And the week after that, we got Mary B. from the Biscayne. And Leslie's grand sponsor, right? Is that right? Yeah. Is that okay to say that? I don't know. But anyway, Mary is here all the time at 5:45. And every time she shares... it helps somebody. Definitely does. I know that she said a lot of things that stuck with me. So anyway, there are no other announcements. I'd like to remind everyone that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And for those who will, please join us for the Lord's Prayer. Okay, who always makes a great meeting?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, and as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Keep coming back to work. Good job, man. Great job. Wasn't that fun?
Yeah, fun.
Okay.
Would you crank?